Hey, 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 Soul Tribe. Welcome back. This is episode 2.3 of Beyond Deconstructing Neurodivergence. I'm your host, T. Jamaica Pogue, affectionately known as Deconstructing Neuro. And today's episode is brought to you by the Neuro Spicy Bodega. Step into a world where fashion meets neurodiversity, where your uniqueness is celebrated with style and flair. Welcome to the Neuro Spicy Bodega, where we're all about embracing your neural spicy identity in the most fashionable way possible. Picture this, the Spicy Spectrum Collection, a burst of colors celebrating the beautiful diversity of the neurodivergent experience. Or how about the Monospice Collection, where minimalist elegance makes a bold and serene statement. And don't miss the iconic Bodega Collection, a heartfelt homage to the haven that is noise-canceling headphones for those of us with sensory sensitivities. Whether you're on the spectrum, embracing minimalism, or seeking solace in sensory protection, the Neuro Spicy Bodega has something for everyone. Join us in celebrating the multifaceted nature of neurodiversity. Wear your story with pride and make a statement that's uniquely you. As a special thank you for being part of the Beyond Deconstructing family, enjoy $10 off your first order of $50 or more using promo code BEYOND. And don't forget to sign up for the Neuro Spicy Bodega mailing list to be the first to know about new releases and promotions. Visit theneurospicybodega.com today and let your style speak volumes about your incredible neurospicy identity. For this week's TikTok therapy, I am going to share with you guys a video from one of my mutuals, Morgan Foley. I'm going to tag her and put all of her socials in the description. Make sure you go and give her a follow. And I'm going to expand on it a little bit more. Right now, I'm just going to go ahead and turn it over to her and then I'll be back.
Talk therapy does not work for me because I am too self-aware and also I can't unmask in therapy. It's a terrible combination to be self-aware and mentally unstable because I know exactly what my problems are. I don't need you to tell them to me. And everything that you suggest, I've already tried. So I just get angry at the person because I'm like, you're supposed to have answers. I've already tried all of this. And then I can't unmask in therapy. Masking is basically people-pleasing, and so I tell therapists whatever they want to hear. Most of the time, a therapist will be like, oh, well, how do you feel about this specific thing? And I have alexithymia, which means I don't know how I feel about things in the moment. So I either sit there and say, I don't know, or I just lie. And most of the time I just lie because sitting there and saying I don't know to every question is not helpful. Well, I mean, neither is lying, but like, what else do you want me to do? I don't have an answer to your questions. And I also struggle to communicate how I'm feeling. So I spend 20 minutes trying to explain how I feel and they still don't get it. And they're like, oh, you mean like this? And I want to scream and be like, no, I don't mean that. But at that point, I'm so mentally exhausted that I'm just like, yep, you got it.
Like, no notes. No notes at all. So glad that she brought this up. And then I actually saw her follow-up video where, because that video went viral, it left autistic TikTok and found its way over to the For You page. And there's a lot of people who just don't get it, who completely misunderstood what she was trying to say and mischaracterized it and used it as fuel to further try to, use ableist rhetoric against autistic people. But I completely 100% agree with what she said. And I've seen this in the community as well, where other people have talked about, well, therapy just doesn't work for me. And I feel like she put it so well. One of the things that that first came to my mind when I listened to this was about something that I talk about a lot, which is top-down thinking versus bottom-up thinking. And I feel like a lot of therapists, if they are holistic, especially if they are not even any kind of neurodivergent, they are going to be seeing things from a purely holistic, purely neurotypical perspective, whether they've had any kind of continuing education about neurodivergence or not, right? A lot of them aren't even trained to spot neurodivergence. A lot of them are trained with certain things in mind and certain things that they're looking for, as opposed to taking in a bunch of information and then narrowing it down from the information they received. A lot of the times they'll start at a conclusion and filter everything through that conclusion. And this is why traditional therapies don't really work for us when you're dealing with people who have top-down thinking, because the questions become prompts to give them the answers that they're looking for, as opposed to being what we need, what autistic people need, which is direction on how to handle the things we're already aware of. So one of the things that Morgan brought up that like really struck a chord with me was the fact that like you can't, it's hard to unmask around someone that you don't feel actually sees you. And when you're in a talk therapy situation with an autistic person, most likely a neurotypical person or someone who upholds neurotypical standards and sees that as the goal to where everyone should be trying to strive towards, when you're in that kind of situation, you don't feel safe because you don't feel seen. You don't feel like you're being heard. You feel like you're being observed and studied. And if you are anything like me or anything like a lot of other autistic people that I know, we have been the biggest students of our own minds for as long as we can remember. Just from being ostracized from the rest of society for one reason or another, being disciplined for our behaviors or things that are natural expressions of our neurodivergent minds, being treated like they were behavioral issues. So a lot of us are very familiar with the process of being introspective and asking questions of why am I like this and why do I do this, to the point that a lot of us have figured out the why behind the what. And our issue is that we need someone to help us with the what, because understanding the why isn't enough for us to enact change. We already understand the why most of the time, but it's the extra step or the suggestions or the tools that we could use to work with the way our brains actually work to help us achieve the standard of living or the life that we are looking to achieve. And what talk therapy does is it is geared toward people who are overall not very introspective, and so they need the help of someone else to ask themselves the questions that a lot of autistic people naturally already pose to ourselves. And so we spend a lot of time not being comfortable enough, not feeling seen enough to unmask and be fully honest. Also, a lot of us struggle with alexithymia. So being unable to really even like articulate or understand the emotions that you're feeling, where they're coming from, or why you're feeling, to answer the kind of questions that come out of talk therapy, like it's so layered. But again, when people hear this, if they're not familiar with it, or if it just doesn't make sense to them, if it's not something that they struggle with, they'll hear it as an excuse. And they'll be like, oh, well, you just don't want therapy to work for you. Or it's up to you to open up to your therapist and to be honest with them. But if the therapist isn't asking questions that actually get to the root of our issues or help us connect the dots, then it doesn't fall squarely on us as the client or as the person in therapy. We need a trauma-informed, a neurodivergent-informed therapist who is going to ask the questions that will actually get us to the place that we need to get to the answer that we're all trying to seek, basically. And again, traditional talk therapy, they ask a lot of open-ended questions. They ask a lot of probing questions that are designed to get you to think about the why behind the what, the motivation behind your behaviors. But if that's something that you're already doing and you already have figured out, hey, yeah, I do this, or I've been doing this, or I feel like I've been doing X, Y, and Z, and you've figured out the pattern, your biggest hurdle now is figuring out how you can work within your neurotype to still achieve what you're trying to achieve. A lot of the tools that traditional talk therapy provides do nothing for us, because it's just further introspection, further shadow work. And it's like, well, I don't need to pay you $100 every, you know, couple of days or every couple of weeks to you know, check my work on something that I've already been doing. Like, it's not really a help. Can you tell me, Can you give me some tools that will help me when I am, you know, experiencing executive dysfunction, but still need to get things done because I'm an adult and I need to be able to get my projects done on time, do this work, pay a bill, run this errand, go to the doctor? Can you help me? Because I know in my mind that I'm supposed to do this. Shame and fear and guilt are not enough of a motivator to get me out of bed some days. Even though I know I am supposed to do it, I sometimes struggle with so much executive dysfunction that I cannot get out of bed, but my mind also is not resting because the entire time I'm laying in bed, my mind keeps guilt tripping me over all the things that I should be doing. So I need someone to help me with tools that a neurodivergent, that an autistic person can use to get past these hurdles, because I understand the why. I even understand what it is, but I need your help as a trauma-informed, neurodivergent-informed therapist to give me some tools that will actually work with who I am and not cause further burnout, not try to make me more autistic or give me tools to try to suppress who I am as an autistic person so that I can function in a more autistic way. That's what we face when we go to traditional talk therapy, or most therapies that are aimed toward neurodivergent people have the end goal of making you more neurotypical, of getting you to function in a neurotypical way. That's never going to happen. We are not neurotypical. We are not holistic. We are not going to be able to uphold those standards without literally killing ourselves, like burning out to the point where we can't function, we get ill, or we off ourselves. So this is why it is important that we have a separate field of study and a separate criteria and way of providing therapy when it comes to people who are autistic, who have ADHD or other neurodivergencies that impact our ability to function the way a neurotypical society dictates we're supposed to function. Today, I am thrilled to introduce to you a dynamic individual who has been at the forefront of a movement dedicated to building a more inclusive and equitable world. Ben Van Hook is an internationally acclaimed disability rights activist. With a deep commitment to the neurodivergent and disabled communities, Ben has dedicated his life to advocating for our rights, particularly within the realms of education and employment. His passion and dedication has taken him to some of the world's most influential platforms, including the United Nations and the International Finance Committee, where he's spoken boldly about the imperative need for disability-related employment reform. And it doesn't stop there. Ben's influence extends to academia, where he shared his insights and expertise with institutions like Stanford University, Johns Hopkins University, Chestnut Hill College, and George Mason University. His discussions about education reform in relation to disability have left an indelible mark on the academic landscape. What makes Ben's advocacy even more compelling is his perspective on intersectionality. As a Chinese-born, Jewish, neurodivergent adoptee, he recognizes the importance of these different intersections in understanding the complex tapestry of human identity in today's world. So today we're privileged to have Ben Van Hook on Beyond Deconstructing, and join us as we delve into a world of disability rights, the power of intersectionality, and the transformative potential of a more neuro-inclusive society.
Yes, thank you. It's really nice to be on here, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. My name's Ben Van Hook. I'm an autistic master's student studying public policy at George Mason University with an emphasis in education policy. I currently work at the Organization for Autism Research, which is an organization that's dedicated to funding applied research studies to better support the autistic community. In my spare time, I do a lot of advocacy work where I like speak on different panels and different podcasts and different give different presentations talking about employment and education reform and how we can better support and accommodate the neurodivergent community as a whole, and how we can best create a more neuro-inclusive society.
That's awesome. And I'm so excited to dive deeper into the work that you're doing. But to start, I always like to give my guests an opportunity to share their unique stories of understanding how, understanding that they are neurodivergent, in particular autistic. So Ben, could you give us a little bit more background about your childhood and how you came to understand what it meant to be autistic?
Yep. So I was diagnosed as autistic at 5 years old. But I didn't really know that I was autistic until I was around like 17, 18. I was looking at different colleges and different universities to go to in my senior year of high school. I was browsing the different universities and supports with my college counselor. And she told me that we should probably look at colleges with autism programs. And that was the first time I had heard the word autism before. And I was shocked. I was like, what is autism? Is it something that's dangerous? Is it something I should be afraid of? Is it, you know, something that can hurt me or whatever? But she was able to talk to me a little bit about autism and how people who are autistic think differently and behave perhaps differently than neurotypicals might. And that was really how my advocacy journey kind of started, just learning about myself, learning about what I needed. And I was a little bit, it was a lot to take in at the moment. So over the next like few weeks before like college, I was just researching and learning all I could about autism. And it actually gave me a greater sense as to who I am. And it also made me feel more comfortable with being myself, and it made me more comfortable advocating for my needs, because I began to understand myself as I did more and more research into autism and how it can affect someone's life. So I was able to not only talk about what I needed, but say why I needed it. So I could say, hey, I need a break because I feel a little bit overwhelmed right now. And I could also talk about what might happen if I didn't get that accommodation. So I could say, if I'm not able to take a break, then I might shut down, or I might not feel as comfortable in this environment, and this might happen. So it helped me become a better self-advocate, learning about my diagnosis. And it also helped me feel better about myself. It made me feel like I wasn't like an accident. I wasn't a mistake. And it gave me a sense of community. Like, this isn't just a me thing. This is something that encompasses an entire community. And from there, I began to like make friends and meet other autistic individuals in college and beyond college on LinkedIn, and learn about their stories and be able to just connect with them on a personal and professional level. And as a result, that's kind of how my advocacy career kind of got started.
That's awesome. I wanted to expand a little bit more on how you were diagnosed at five, but you didn't find out until you were graduating high school. Could you expand a little bit more on how that could be possible?
Yeah, I think it was something that my parents kind of hid from me. They didn't think I was ready to learn about my autism. I was still getting the supports, but I didn't realize it. Like, I had an IEP, but I wasn't brought into any IEP meetings. I didn't know about my IEP. I just kind of went with the flow. So, for example, I was taken out of like the general classroom to learn in a specialized environment, like for math and for reading comprehension. And this was like a group of six or seven people who also turned out to be neurodivergent, but I was kind of taken out of the classroom without any reason as to why I was being taken out, and it happened every single day. And as a result, I kind of felt a little bit awkward, because I was leaving the general classroom. I was automatically kind of put into people's outgroups and made it harder to become friends with people because I wasn't with them the majority of the day. And as a result, I just found like making friendships really difficult in elementary school because of these individualized learning environments. I was also attending a private middle school and high school for neurodivergent people, but I didn't realize it was for neurodivergent individuals at the time. I thought it was to kind of protect me because I was bullied a lot as like a child. In like fifth and sixth grade, I was bullied because I was only Asian American in my class. And people were telling me things like, go back to your own country, or we hate the Chinese. And I just asked my parents continuously, can you take me, can you put me in a different school? I don't want to go to the middle school where all the bullies are going to. So I thought that being put into a different school was just because I didn't want to be bullied, but I only found out later it was because these schools were tailored towards neurodivergent individuals.
Wow, thank you for that. That had to have been kind of difficult to reconcile with. And I have a question for you. It's theoretical, but do you feel that if you were bought into the conversation about your IEP and the way that you were going to be accommodated, if that would have helped you to come into your sense of self and be more comfortable with who you are a bit sooner, so that you wouldn't continue to feel like you were a mistake or feel like you were awkward, you would know that it's because you have a completely different kind of neurotype?
Yeah, I definitely think it would have helped me. I think it would have helped to know that I wasn't like an accident, and to know that like different challenges I face aren't like unique to me, but encompass the whole community. So it would have made me feel like I wasn't alone in this. And it would have helped me open up to other people maybe in these special education classes and ask if like they want to become friends or ask about their interests or learn more about neurodiversity as a whole. I also think being able to like be like brought into these conversations earlier would have made me a better self-advocate, and it would have made me more comfortable self-advocating and given me practice early on talking about what I needed and why I needed it, because it would have helped me understand myself. And if I can understand myself, then I'll be able to like state what I needed to like the professor or to the person I was speaking to, parents, peers, classmates, and I'd be able to explain it in a way that wasn't just like because I want to, because that was usually what happened. I was like, can I take a break from this? And people would ask me why, and I would just be like, because I want a break, instead of like actually understanding why I physiologically needed that break. So I think it would have helped me explain myself better, and it would have helped me become a stronger self-advocate from like at a younger age.
That's a very important point. That is something that unfortunately is a common thread amongst a lot of autistic people, especially those who are who become aware of their autism later in life. And even though you were diagnosed at 5, you were not aware of it until later in life. And so, unfortunately, it conditions us to believe that our needs are actually being difficult. And a lot of us have our issues dismissed away as behavioral issues, as opposed to being a need that accompanies our neurotype. And so I'm very glad to hear that you have used that experience to help yourself become a greater self-advocate. And so could you expand on the ways that you advocate for autism acceptance, and if there are any organizations or initiatives that you support currently that really help to drive home the mission of autism acceptance, not just awareness?
Yep. So I actually want to touch upon a point you just made real quick, and that was about like intersectionality and about how it would have like helped me understand myself better. Because as like an autistic individual, I'm also Asian American, and being Asian American comes with like its own unique challenges. And if you're Asian American and adopted, as well as like neurodivergent, there's a lot of intersections that many non-adopted white autistics don't really understand or go through. And there's a lot more barriers that kind of encompass who we are. And I think it's important to recognize that like we do go through different challenges, and that things that pop up maybe behaviorally are usually due to the environment or the climate we were raised in rather than our behavior itself. And I think that's also why transitioning to a social model of disability is so important, to take into account like many different societal factors, from racism to discrimination to like persecution of religion, because I was also bullied for being Jewish as well. So I think being able to recognize someone's whole experience as opposed to what people are just seeing on the outside, like temper tantrums, for example, is really important. What was the second question? Sorry.
That's okay. So no, understanding this fully and knowing about the importance of taking an intersectional lens or viewing autism through an intersectional lens, how do you advocate for autism acceptance now?
So I used to advocate for autism acceptance, but I've since gone one further and advocate for autism appreciation. And it's just as like awareness is different from acceptance, I think acceptance is different from appreciation. And I think that we need to advocate more and push more for appreciation and transition into a society where appreciation is the norm. And I think we're ready to do so, because we have more autistic individuals graduating high school and entering college than ever before. We have more autistic individuals and people in the workplace than ever before. And we have more knowledge, more tools, and more resources at our disposal around autism than we have ever had previously. So I think we need to transition and go one further and really talk about transitioning to autism appreciation. And some of the differences that I've made between acceptance and appreciation is that acceptance is hiring because you have to, whereas appreciation is hiring because you want to. Wow. To me, acceptance is doing the bare minimum to make sure that we're surviving as a community, whereas appreciation is going above and beyond to ensure that our community is not only surviving, but thriving. And to me, acceptance is acknowledging and accepting that bridges exist, whereas appreciation is actively taking steps to build upon those bridges, to make them stronger, and to really bridge that gap between different neurotypes, to help us work together, help us collaborate on different projects, to help us understand each other more, and to really promote a world in which all neurotypes, both neurotypical and neurodivergent, are not only accepted, but appreciated and celebrated in society. So I honestly think we have to go one further and move towards appreciation.
I love that. I absolutely love that. And I completely agree. Yes, I think that that is definitely the direction where we need to go. My personal stance is I've moved away from just autism awareness, because that's what I was thinking. Basically, your definition of autism acceptance is what I defined as autism awareness. But you make a very good point that just accepting us or just being tolerant of us is not taking it far enough. We need to build a world where there's equity and appreciation for the unique differences that our neurotype can bring to the workplace, can bring to academia, and can even bring to social structures like direct communication and being logical and not necessarily as emotion-based. Those things can actually help us to build a deeper connection with each other, because instead of going through these barriers and these layers of passive social implications, we can get to the point, kind of eliminate or greatly reduce the anxiety that's associated with trying to read the signs and actually start to build these deeper connections.
Yep. And there are many ways we can do that. For example, we could like follow, read, and like listen to podcasts and different like articles, blogs written by neurodivergent individuals. We can also like attend different panels and presentations that are given by neurodivergent people, so we can learn from the neurodivergent themselves what the experience of being neurodivergent is like. I also think we could utilize a universal design model for education and employment. So every neurotype is accommodated, and people don't have to ask for accommodations to begin with because they're like provided beforehand. And I believe this is important because it reduces the need to disclose, which can be really uncomfortable. And it also provides accommodations for people who maybe were misdiagnosed, particularly females, at a younger age, so they can get the supports they need, even if they don't have a diagnosis or a correct diagnosis of autism. They could still get the supports in education that they need. I also think it's important to just listen to autistic individuals without judgment and without like saying, oh, my, like, let's say my grandson's autistic, he's not anything like you, how do you know you're autistic? I think it's important to recognize we're all different and to just listen to each of our stories and to understand that the environment we're in contributes, plays a role into how we develop, how we grow, and that each of our experiences as autistic individuals are going to be different. So I think being able to listen and learn from us without judgment is really important and a great way to transition from acceptance to appreciation.
Absolutely. And you bring up a great point. That is something that I feel it has been a universal experience in the last few years with the increase in people later in life in adulthood understanding that they are autistic and then having their diagnosis, whether it's confirmed by a clinical diagnosis or if they're still self-identified, having it being dismissed away by other people who have a singular idea in mind or what I call the face of autism, what they immediately imagine when they hear autism. And then they look at you and they compare you to someone who fits the stereotype, which has overwhelmingly been a very narrow representation of autism. And they use that as a way to justify not accommodating you or not believing you. And so this kind of touches back on something that we've brought up, or two things that we brought up, which is intersectionality, as well as viewing autism through the social model of disability. So I'll start with intersectionality. Because we are all like we have identities that are multifaceted. If you are someone who diverges from what has been considered the norm, which has been white, cishet, male, you have additional layers and additional barriers to to access, and your autism is going to present in different ways because that's who the population of autism was originally studied on. So I'd like to hear from you a little bit more about how you use your intersections to help inform other people about just how vast the spectrum of autism is and how it presents and the importance of appreciating those intersections when you are interacting with actually autistic people.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think the most important way is through telling our stories. And some of the stories we tell can be painful to listen to because they're either like really traumatic or they're like something that evokes really strong emotions. Something that a common problem I had as a child was that I was racially abused in school, kind of like what I talked about before, where people would say really mean things to me and tell me like to go back to my own country. And I would tell my teachers about the bullying. I would tell my parents about the bullying. And I was ignored because my teachers were white, my parents were white. And instead of trying to understand me, they immediately told me I was misperceiving of the situation. I was misunderstanding the intention. Sometimes I was told the bullies were only joking, even though jokes usually don't end in tears. But I was given every explanation under the sun other than the person was bullying me. And it hurt my trust in authority figures because I was not really supported by these authority figures I was supposed to trust as a kid. I was kind of abandoned by them when I really needed support through the bullying. So the way intersectionality has played in throughout my life was this constant fear of abandonment and this constant like distrust of authority figures to truly support my needs and understand where I'm coming from. And this has led me to like seek out other intersectional individuals like on LinkedIn and form different personal connections with them, form friendships with them, and be able to bond over these shared traumas and be able to kind of talk and heal together. There's a lot of different sections I'm a part of, such as being Jewish, being Asian American, and also being adopted. And sometimes like I might not present as like a stereotypical, prototypical autistic person. Like I'm someone who really likes socializing, and I love interpersonal communication with other people. And that might be because as a kid, I wasn't really given that social interaction. I was abandoned by my first caregiver. I wasn't really loved or supported in the way I needed to be supported. Some people might think of autistic people as not really having emotions, having a flat affect. But for me, like I'm someone who's really emotional. I'm someone who is really passionate about so many things in the disability community. I'm someone who gets overwhelmed really easily. I'm someone who just shows like wears my emotions on my sleeve. And I think a lot of that is because just kind of because of my experiences as an intersectional individual in the past and not really having been heard or seen. So I think intersectionality is really important to take into consideration when it comes to how we might present as autistic individuals.
Absolutely. I fully agree. And I know we spoke previously, and I've been open previously about being a Black woman, being physically disabled for a while because I was in a wheelchair for a little while when I was in seventh grade, dealt with bullying, and also later in my adulthood coming out as queer, having this like sitting in almost every intersection. I completely understand how that is important and why we need to be viewing autism. And I feel like everyone outside of even this autism, we need to take people's intersections into account, because something you brought up stating that, you know, being adopted into a white family, being in a school with primarily white teachers, they were assuming, or it seemed like they were assuming, that you understood that to them in their culture, that bullying or making jokes that are mean are supposed to be considered normal and that you're not supposed to be offended by that. And because of that, they made it your problem that you received something that really hurt you the way that you received it. And that, unfortunately, I think is a common occurrence when we don't take into effect that the way you think and what you think is culturally normal is not going to be the same across the board, especially once you add more and more intersections into it.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's important to see each other as human, like before anything else, just see that we're another human being with complex needs, with a wide variety of different experiences, whether we're neurodivergent or not. And I think it's important to treat everyone like they're human and to like treat everyone with compassion and with understanding. Even if you don't really understand what they're going through, just validating those experiences and taking the time to listen to them instead of forming different judgments can be really helpful. If there is a lot of judgment, especially early on, it can lead to a lot of different problems in the future, like anxiety and RSD, rejection sensitivity dysphoria. That's something that I've been going through my whole life. So I think just being able to validate different experiences, regardless of neurotype, is really important.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And part of validating people's different experiences, I think, leads into the second point that I wanted to touch on, which is the social model of disability versus the medical model of disability. Because when we look at autism exclusively through the medical model of disability, those who are deemed to have lower support needs, or the defunct label that I don't like to use, high functioning, a lot of the times when we do ask for accommodations, they're dismissed as, you just want to get special treatment, you don't really need this. Or if you're someone like myself who found out later in life that you're autistic, well, you used to be able to do this, why do you need these accommodations now? And if we transition to the social model of disability, understanding that our environment and our society highly impacts the level to which we are disabled, I think that that is something important. So I would love to hear you speak a little bit more on your views on the social model of disability versus the medical model of disability in particular, and how it affects neurodivergent people.
I think the medical model is really harmful to the neurodivergent population because it pathologizes us and it makes us seem like the problem. And a lot of times, especially in school and sometimes in the workplace, when asking for accommodations, these things kind of pop up. So sometimes I give the example of someone like who might be hard of hearing. Someone who is hard of hearing but attends a meeting, they might ask for like different accommodations. And if someone prescribes as a social model, they would talk about providing the closed captionings for the meetings, having a translator, like an American Sign Language translator. But someone who prescribes to the medical model might be like, oh, you're deaf or hard of hearing, why don't you buy some hearing aids? Instead of like understanding that the environment can easily change to accommodate and support the needs of someone who might learn or process information differently by adding in these closed captionings. When it comes to the social model, I've always advocated for having a more universal design-based approach to both education and employment, because everyone is different and their needs are different. And if we provide them, everyone, the supports they need, both neurotypicals and neurodivergent supports they need to succeed, then everyone can take more out of their education because they're learning in an environment that suits them. And they're able to practice self-advocacy through choosing how they want to learn and choosing the supports they need. And they're also learning more about themselves in the process, what works for them, what might not work for them. So in terms of the social model, I think universal design is a really important way to go to provide everyone the right environment for them and the accommodations they need, instead of seeing accommodations as like something that's a burden to the organization or to the school. That was honestly the sense I was getting. Like when I asked for accommodations, I always felt like I was like burdening other people because they have to go out of their way to provide that. And the accommodations process itself can be really exhausting. It can be really tiring, really confusing, and really stressful. It can also be really traumatizing because as neurodivergents, many of us have had to like go through life justifying our existence. We have had people like say to us, you don't look disabled, or how disabled are you? And in the accommodations process, you have to show like why you need this accommodation to like work, or why like doing the task without the accommodation is like harmful to one's like performance or like ability to fulfill the task. So by asking them to again justify themselves and their existence and who they are is really harmful to one's like sense of self and one's well-being, because instead of living as ourselves, we're living life having to constantly justify our existence as neurodivergent beings and why we need certain things. So I think it's important to realize that we all need different things, and providing all accommodations from the outset can really help with this process.
Absolutely. I completely agree. You bring up several very salient points that I unfortunately relate to in my journey to get accommodations. I completely support a universal design because, as you stated, both neurotypical and neurodivergent people, we can all benefit from some of the accommodations that, if they were just standard, would really help with our performance, with lowering anxiety, with feeling genuine acceptance. One of the ones that immediately came to mind for me was working from home or working remotely.
That was mine as well. Yeah, that was mine as well. I was denied that accommodation. Basically what happened was I asked for that accommodation because I was, and this is where interception plays a part, because like in January there was a few shootings on Lunar New Year, like towards Asian American community and population. Mm. And it just made me feel unsafe. And I asked, can I work from home? And I was basically threatened with my job. They said, if you work from home or want to work from home, we might not be able to offer you this position, because I was applying for a different position in the organization. And that threat in and of itself was enough to make me like drop my concerns, because I needed a source of income. And honestly, that's why advocating for my own needs is so hard, because 99% of the time I feel like they're going to get rejected, or the organization doesn't feel like there's a problem burdening me enough to justify providing an accommodation. So it can be really difficult gaining, like, you know, finding the courage to advocate for ourselves, because we know we're just going to be pushed down 99% of the time. And it's sometimes doesn't feel like it's worth like the energy or the trauma to kind of go through this process. I made a post yesterday where I just stated flat out, the accommodations process should not feel like climbing Mount Everest.
Yes.
It should be easy to understand, and it should be fair. So I think, especially for reasonable accommodations, they should just be provided. We shouldn't have to justify ourselves or why we need it. When I was in school and asked for accommodations, the teachers would basically say, like, if we give you this, we're going to have to give everyone this. And I was like, maybe you should give everyone this. Maybe you should give everyone extended time. Maybe you should give everyone a fidget toy. And I think one of the problems is that, like, many teachers don't really understand the difference between equity and equality. Mm. Because, like, sure, you can give everyone a fidget toy, but not everyone's going to use it. Not everyone's going to need it. Similar to if you, like, give everyone a Band-Aid, not everyone's going to use the Band-Aid, just those with like cuts or scars. People with bruises might not use the Band-Aid. So it's a lot of teachers seem to lack that fundamental knowledge as to the difference between equity and equality, and why it's important to understand that even if we provide everyone everything, they're not going to use it. Like, they're not going to use every accommodation that we give them.
Exactly. And that example in the school, in academia, flows right over into the workplace. So we saw that, it, you know, during the height of the pandemic, when everyone had to work from home, there were still so many people who were anxious and itching to get back into the office. And as soon as the office opened up, they were right back there. So if you gave everyone the option to work remotely 100% of the time, there still isn't going to be 100% of the workforce that takes you up on that, because everyone is an individual. Everyone has their own, you know, needs. Some people need to be in that social environment to feel motivated to do their job. And then there are some people who get highly distracted and are highly anxious in that social environment, who would actually do better if they were able to be removed from the social pressures of the environment and be able to just focus on their work.
Yeah, and that's also where intersectionality comes in, because like people of color might feel a lot more anxious being in the workplace, especially like as hate crimes rise against Asian Americans, against African Americans, against all different intersections, people who are part of the LGBTQIA plus community. Like, this is where intersectionality plays a part, because a lot of these communities might feel hesitant or anxious or nervous going back into the office. And supervisors and managers who are just like cis white males might not really understand why people might feel anxious. And as a result, those accommodations of working from home will be rejected, because these white people might assume, oh, we're just over-exaggerating the fears, even though these are real and present dangers in society, especially in this day and age. So I think intersectionality is really important to consider when it comes to providing accommodations.
Absolutely, absolutely. You make a great point. That actually kind of segued me into thinking about the increase in the DEIB space ever since 2020. We all saw that massive cultural shift after what happened to George Floyd. I feel like that was a marker in time where you can look before that and after that to see this shift in corporate structures and in academic structures, where they are putting forth more of a public effort to talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. And that's a great thing in and of itself. But I would love to get your opinion on this, because in my eyes, I feel like a lot of it is performative, because they know it's what they're supposed to do. And because of that, their efforts are not being led by highly intersectional people who will take disability into account as much as they focus on perhaps things like race, gender, and sexuality, which are all important. But I feel like it's an incomplete view at what true diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging should look like.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. There's a few ways we can look at it. The first being that it's good knowing these organizations are like raising awareness for these issues. But as you say, they are like performative. And I personally think the most, the organizations that are the most inclusive are the ones that stay silent and silently implement these changes, because they know that, that this is performative. And they also, I think that it's important to recognize that the celebration of diversity is more of an indictment on society than it is a celebration. It is more a testament to how behind we are that we have to celebrate and promote our achievement of hiring a diverse group of people than it is a celebration. I think that we should expect to hire diverse, and shouldn't be this Herculean task that is celebrated you won a gold medal at the Olympics. I mean, we should be doing this. And if we celebrate hiring diverse, then it makes me question where are our standards as society? How low are our standards if we're celebrating the hiring of a Black woman or an Asian American man for this position? I think we have to recognize that this is something we should be doing. And this is why I appreciate different organizations that are silent about diversity, but do it because they know it's the right thing to do, not because they know people are just going to be talking about them on social media. But that's kind of my take on diversity. I think the best diversity happens in silence and is not performative.
I 100% agree. You make a great point. Because if you do it silently, like you said, it's because you know it's the right thing to do, not because you want to get brownie points, not because you want to appear to be inclusive and you want to avoid the backlash. And unfortunately, that's what I've been seeing a lot of when I look at a lot of these companies across the board, whether it's companies or schools or whatever, where during Pride Month, the first thing they want to do is change their logo to be a rainbow. And that's it. That's all they'll do. But we're allies. And my question is, how safe do the queer people at your company feel to be out and proud at work? Or, you know, during April, during Autism Awareness Month, how safe do the neurodivergent people in your company feel being open about their neurodivergence and advocating for themselves and having confidence in receiving the accommodations that they're seeking without facing the backlash of having their job threatened or having their peers look at them like they think that they're special? You know, that's the true test to whether or not it's in the DNA of your organization or if whether you're just trying to avoid the scrutiny that is rightly coming now that we are becoming more aware of how our standard as society has not progressed with us as people.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I actually made a post on LinkedIn about this about a month ago. It was in May for AAPI Heritage Month. And I talked about how I, as an Asian American, wasn't celebrating or recognizing AAPI Heritage Month because to me, it just felt performative. It felt fake. It felt tokenizing. It felt like these people are just going to post pictures of them with AAPI community members. And then the very next month, they're just going to be blaming Asian Americans for the coronavirus. They're going to be continuing like the hate crimes, racist rhetoric and everything that like preceded the month of May. And like in my post, I literally stated, if you truly want to support the AAPI community, it's important to teach about the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 in school, the Geary Act of 1892. It's important to talk about the effects of the Japanese internment camps from a Japanese perspective in American schools if we really want to understand the Asian American community, the different histories and the different traumas and trials and like triumphs that we've faced. And I think it's important to learn from an Asian American perspective, not a white perspective, but an Asian American perspective, what we've gone through in the past 100 to 200 years. So I think it's important to recognize actual steps we could take other than posting on social media when it comes to like supporting these communities. And it's the same with like Autism Acceptance Month. It's the same with Black History Month and everything. Like, it's just like a month of tokenizing one community and then just forgetting about them until the next year rolls around. So I think we have to do more as a community if we want to support marginalized communities and groups.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. And I know that we touched on this a little earlier, but having the people from those marginalized communities be the ones to drive the conversation is the biggest step, in my opinion, that we can take when it comes to fully understanding and appreciating marginalized communities. Because whether it's your disability or your gender identity or your race, your culture, for so long, it has been presented from an external lens. So people who are not even within that group are the ones who have been allowed to have the loudest voice in quote unquote advocating for us. But what that does is it brings along a misunderstanding that is inherent when you do not have the lived experience. So I feel like people get that nowadays when it comes to, well, you can't be white and talk about Black experiences louder than a Black person, or you can't be, you know, straight and talk about the gay experience louder than a gay person. But I do still feel that we've fallen behind in regards to autism because we're so often infantilized that people think that, oh, they can't talk for themselves, so let us, because we care, speak for them. And then we get hate groups like Autism Speaks.
Yeah, and then if like, and it's funny because like these same people are thinking we have like a Black and white way of thinking, but they're the ones who are like saying or thinking we're either incompetent or we're these super smart like Sheldon Cooper geniuses, instead of realizing that we are all different and we are all unique and we are able to advocate for ourselves given the right environment. And if we feel safe in that environment to advocate for ourselves. And you brought up a great point earlier about like people who are part of the community driving these movements. And I agree that like with autism and the move to appreciation, we are behind. And I think it's important to put autistic people in the driver's seat. The way I kind of see self-advocates and allies are that allies can serve as a roadmap. They can serve as a guide. They can give suggestions that the autistic person may or may not follow, but the autistic person themselves has to steer the ship. They have to be the steering wheel. They have to make those decisions based on that guidance, and they have to be the ones to make that final decision. There shouldn't be people asking, are you sure about this, or making decisions for them. It should be the autistic person making decisions given like the information and knowledge and resources they have. And that's where at least my end goal of advocacy is, and that is empowerment. To me, empowering neurodivergent people, autistic people, ADHD, dyslexia, all neurodivergent people is putting neurodivergence in the driving seat and allowing them to steer the ship of their lives, allowing them to take control over like what they want, why they want it, and be able to make decisions on their own, independent of what anyone else thinks. To me, empowerment means giving neurodivergence the resources and tools to make their own decisions, but also not making the decision for them. So I think it's important we put autistic individuals and other neurodivergents in the driving seat and allow them to make their own decisions. And they might make mistakes, but I think it's important to realize that making mistakes is human. You know, it's how we learn, is how we grow. And it's not the end of the world if a neurodivergent makes a mistake. They're just going to learn another way of doing things. So I think being able to give them the power to make mistakes and to steer their own ship is really important.
Absolutely. That autonomy is 100% needed. Because, yeah, going back to the infantilization, I feel like that is completely because of the way that autism has been portrayed, because it has been portrayed from an holistic lens. And it only narrowly shows, like you said earlier, either Rain Man or Sheldon Cooper. There's no in between. And by allowing us to share our stories and our lived experiences, it will help to add that much needed nuance to the discussion and help people to realize that this is not something that we need to eradicate or find a cure for, but we need to appreciate the differences and how our strengths can help benefit society as a whole.
And I think that's also important to recognize, that we need to take a strengths-based approach to everything we do, because everyone, regardless of neurotype, has strengths. And unfortunately for neurodivergence, where like many of us have just lived in a world where our weaknesses were the only thing we knew. And it's important to see that everyone does have these strengths and build upon these strengths. And it's also important to realize that like not everyone's going to be good at everything. Even for neurotypicals, not everyone's good at everything. And it's important to hone in on these strengths and hone in on our talents and skills and abilities, and be able to build upon them and use them when necessary. That's how I want a business to be run. Bringing in people with unique strengths and talents. Maybe someone's good at writing, give them assignments and tasks in their job that have to do with writing. If someone's good at presenting, give them different assignments having to do with presenting, maybe have them represent the organization at different events or different conferences or different like resource fairs. If someone's good at like solving math equations, just let them solve these math equations instead of making the job super complicated where someone has to know like 1500 things and how to use 20,000 different tools. I think it's better if we are able to like stick to our strengths, and if there's a vacancy or knowledge gap, bring in someone who has those strengths to kind of fill in that gap instead of making someone who doesn't have that strength learn and expect to be perfect in that new area. It's kind of like a movie where you bring in people who like fit each role. You wouldn't expect an actor to know how to like do video production. You wouldn't expect someone who was just in charge of like, let's say, script writing to be like one of the main characters in a show. No, you'd expect the script writers to write the scripts. You'd expect the actors and the trained actors to like be cast in the show. You'd expect the producers who were trained in production to produce. You wouldn't expect the producers to be cast in the show either, or else you won't have like a good quality show. But once you put everyone in their trained area, in their skill area, in their areas of strength, that's when like you create this beautiful movie. And it's the same with an organization. If you put everyone in an area they're comfortable in, then you're going to run more efficiently as an organization. So I think having a strength-based approach, especially when it comes to working with neurodivergent individuals, is really important.
I love that analogy of the movie. That perfectly illustrates that, because I don't believe that many people look at their hiring process that way, their policy process that way. And I know for sure you don't look at neurodivergence that way, especially autism, because autism is largely defined by our perceived deficits. And I actually take a lot of offense to the word deficit, because I don't feel like it's a deficit. I feel like it should be replaced with a difference. This is a difference in how I communicate. This is a difference in how I interact socially. It's not a deficit. But when we continue to define it that way, that's why there are so many people who see who don't see us on the same level as a quote unquote normal human, or they see, as soon as they hear the label autism, they have this switch that goes off in their mind, like, oh, well, then they're not able to do this. They're not able to do this, as opposed to being like, oh, you're autistic. Oh, wow. You might actually probably be able to connect the dots that we're not able to see. Or, oh, you're autistic. Are you good with like systems-based thinking? Like, you know, if we just switched from defining everything by its deficits to its strengths, that would actually get us to autism appreciation, or appreciating differences as a whole.
Yeah, for sure. And you also bring up a great point about it not being a deficit. Like, and this is something that I'm really passionate about, that like autism isn't a deficit in communication. It's just a different way of communicating. And there's a framework that I use. It's called the double empathy framework. Mm-hmm. And basically it posits that we don't have deficits in communication. We just communicate better with different neurotypes. And this rings true for me, because many of my close friends in elementary school also later on got diagnosed with like autism or ADHD. We, without knowing we were neurodivergent, just connected with each other. We had no idea about each other's neurotypes. We didn't even know what neurodiversity was. We just connected with each other in elementary school. And we just kind of bonded over special interests, shared interests. We were able to understand each other's humor, each other's interest areas, passions. We were able to connect on many different subjects, and we were just on the same wavelength with so many things. Whereas with other people, it was much more difficult, because they kind of saw me as weird or as like creepy. But I would always find other neurodivergents at any party like I went to, without knowing they're neurodivergent before, because of the way we kind of interact and communicate with each other. So I think it's important to realize that neurodivergents can communicate better, or at least understand neurodivergence better than neurotypical. So it doesn't mean we have a deficit. It just means we communicate better with different groups of people. And I think just having that experience illustrates that we do communicate better with like similar or like-minded neurotypes.
Absolutely. And that actually folds back into a point that you brought up earlier about bridging that gap, like actively bridging the gap from acceptance to appreciation is once we understand that it's just a difference, it's not a deficit, and we stop demonizing or pathologizing those differences, then that actually will help us to communicate across neurotypes a little bit better. So part of my process, and the reason why I even call it deconstructing neurodivergence, is because I've had to go back and deconstruct different experiences I've had with neurotypical people to figure out why those interactions went as poorly as they did, because I knew where I was coming from and I knew what I said and I meant what I said, but I was trying to figure out like why what I said was interpreted a different way. And because I had really good pattern recognition, I was able to put together and realize that it was because we speak, or overall, autistic people are more literal and more direct in our communication. And that's normal communication for us. But for neurotypical people, it is normal communication for them to imply things through passive statements or through emotional kind of manipulation. And I say the word manipulation and sometimes people get offended, but manipulation doesn't have to be negative or positive. You are manipulating someone if you are passively implying something that you expect them to emotionally pick up on. That is how I would describe neurotypical communication. But by understanding both of those things, both how neurotypical and neurodivergent people communicate, if we stop labeling that as a deficit and just look at it as a difference, that I feel like would be one of the major things that could help us communicate across neurotypes a little bit better.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's important to recognize that we do have different strengths, and that our deficits aren't actually deficits because we are able to communicate, maybe just not with the person calling us a deficit. So I think just having like the proof that we can communicate with people who are of a similar neurotype means that we can communicate very well, just not with the people who like see deficits within us. But I think seeing that we can create a social environment, and the LinkedIn world is like a really good example of this. You have a lot of members who are neurodivergent coming together, and they're able to like share their perspectives, share their experiences, and support one another and validate each other's experiences. And through like LinkedIn and these LinkedIn connections, you kind of form a community, you form a family. And through this family, there's a lot of empathy, there's a lot of compassion, there's a lot of love and support of one another, and basically all of the things that people don't expect of us. So I think once we realize that we have a community, and within our community, we interact and understand each other very well, the like deficits approach hopefully will go away. Because like, and I use LinkedIn because it is a really good example of like a neurodivergent community that is very supportive of each other and the members within it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, I'm so excited that we had this conversation, Ben. Before we go, I do want to just ask you a little bit about the projects that you're working on. I know you mentioned what you currently do for work, and I would love for you to expand upon that so that we can learn more about the different ways that self-advocacy is being supported and what resources might be out there for people who are looking to get on the path to being able to advocate for themselves and ask for the accommodations that they rightfully need.
Yep. So I currently work at the Organization for Autism Research, and my job is basically to bring other self-advocates into our organization and to help us create better, improved resources based on the feedback, based on like the needs of the autistic community in 2023. Aside from my work, I am involved in a lot of advocacy on LinkedIn. I make a lot of posts advocating for better accommodations processes, talking about my experiences as an intersectional neurodivergent individual. I also am involved in a lot of research. I'm one of the two student representatives at the American Psychological Association Division 33, which is autism and intellectual disabilities. And I also do a lot of presentations, a lot of like panels relating to employment and education reform in regards to like better supporting the neurodivergent community and creating a more neuro-inclusive community. So I do a lot of work around inclusivity, around intersectionality, and around employment and education reforms.
That's amazing. And outside of LinkedIn, is there anywhere else that we can find your work or support you and join in on your mission to improve self-advocacy and intersectionality?
Yep. So I recently got on medium.com, which is a blogging site. And my profile name is Ben Van Hook. Just my name. I'm also on Facebook as well. And the tag is just my name as well, Ben Van Hook. I'm not really creative or anything. And I'm also on Instagram as well. And my user tag is Ben_VanHook64.
Awesome. I will make sure to leave links in the description so everyone can find you and support your work. I want to thank you again, Ben, for taking time to speak with me and to speak to my audience. I truly appreciate your unique perspective as well as the work that you're doing in our space. LinkedIn is where I found you. I instantly connected with your message, and I'm honored that you gave me some time today to come and talk and share your experience. I really hope you guys enjoyed that interview and found it as enlightening as I did. And just as a little bit of background, I recorded this interview back in June before I took a hiatus for the summer. And this was also before the current ramping up of the tensions between Israel and Palestine. Because one of the things I was thinking of when I was going back and listening to the interview, editing this episode, I really wished I had the opportunity to speak to Ben a little bit more about his thoughts regarding this. Now, being as though we are connected on social media, I have seen some of his recent posts, so I kind of know where he stands, but I just always feel like it resonates a little bit more, it can have a little bit more of an impact when you hear from within the community that is directly affected by what's going on. But I just want to reiterate my stance. I am free Palestine all day, and that is not at all being anti-Semitic. I understand that the government of Israel and the colonial imperialist state of Israel is not the same as Israeli people, is not the same as Jewish people. Just like I am an American born and raised, but my government, especially what they're doing now, does not represent me at all, does not represent who I am, what I believe in, what I fight for at fucking all. And so it's important to understand that even though I am supporting a free Palestine, it doesn't mean that I am anti-Semitic or don't identify with and appreciate the plight of Jewish people. As a Black person, as a Black person in America, I understand deeply what it's like to be displaced and to not have a homeland, to not know where I'm from, to not be able to point to a map and be like, this is where my people are from. This is our home. You know, so being a diasporic person is not a foreign concept to me. But again, being pro-Palestine or being in support of the freedom of the Palestinian people is not tantamount to being anti-Semitic. And I need people to understand that. Being against colonial imperialism and genocide and a one-sided, lopsided war, being against that is not the same as being against Jewish people. And if you feel that way, then you have some very limited and ass backwards ideals of Judaism and the Jewish people as a whole. You've confused Zionism with Judaism, and you need to educate yourself a bit more. But that's me once again. reiterating my point because I feel like it needs to be said over and fucking over again. If you aren't already doing so, if you want to show your support in certain ways, if you have the capacity to do so, make sure you're seeking out reputable organizations to donate your time, your money, and your resources to. If you're not able to provide any kind of monetary or material support or goods, reposting information and videos from people within Palestine, within Gaza, within the West Bank, who are on the Egyptian border, who are on the ground. If you can just share and repost their videos and their information so that their voices don't continue to get silenced by the media conglomerate that's trying to push the same old fucking narrative that they've been pushing for fucking ever. All right, now I'm cursing a little bit worse. I can tell I'm getting a bit upset. So I'm gonna wrap it up here and just say thank you guys once again for stopping by and spending a little bit of time with me today. I truly appreciate it. I hope that everyone is taking care of themselves in the best way that they know how. And just love yourselves, love others, and be safe. I love you all. Hope to catch you back here next week for another episode of Beyond Deconstructing Neurodivergence. Stay blessed.